context, Caroline Casey. So it is an oceanic Jupiter day. We have our wonderful guest, Michael Stocker, whom I will bring in moments. But first, as we know, the annual KPFA Craft Fair will be this weekend, December 3rd and Sunday, December 4th, 10 to 5. There's 150 local artists and craftspeople, wonderful ceramics, jewelry, etc. You can find out more at kpfacraftfair.com. And this Monday, December 5th, it's the Georgia election eve. So we are once again opening Trickster Training Council to all who would like to join in to animate voter turnout and democracy. You can find out more about that at coyotenetworknews.com. It's by donation only. But my election magic council colleague, Pat, writes, "We're in the process of electing the earth as participant and voice in our government. Each election is a step towards the path of having a government in alignment with a higher purpose. Warnock is a deserving and worthy candidate who can convene a roundtable," we're going to get to that, "of ingenious altruism and bring many to it for the greatest good. More than deciding one person over another, we are using the collective process our country has for changing direction to benefit all." Yeah, we'll be animating Warnock as a Leo with his son, sextile Jupiter Uranus, as the black gospel King Arthur who can convene the round table, crucial for the unfolding year before us, and also his Venus quintiles Chiron. So Senator as mentor. There we go. So coyotenetworknews.com to find out about that. So here we are, microdosing vastness. We are welcoming longtime ally Michael Stocker, marine bioacoustician, writer, musician, that we may invoke an oceanic response to dissolve human hubris in the salve of sanity, to protect the ocean, let's become more like the ocean, and weave dedication for collective well-being into all of our thoughts, words, and deeds. Michael is acclaimed and dedicated acoustician by trade and a musician by avocation. He's written and spoken about ocean bioacoustics since 1992, presenting in regional, national, international hearings, TV, radio, and news publications, and the Visionary Activist Show. He's the founding director of Ocean Conservation Research, which is OCR.org. His book, Here, H-E-A-R, Here Where We Are, Sound, Ecology, and Sense of Place, examines the phenomenology, history, and natural history of sound perception of humans and other animals. Welcome, Michael Stocker.
Caroline, what a delight to hear your voice again.
Ah, that's good. Okay, I'm cranking you up. There we go. Many things to begin with, but cultivating an ecological identity with vastness. And what I'd read you backstage, I love our colleague ally, John Seed, who writes in one of the promos for his Australian courses, "Deep ecology is a philosophy of nature which explores the psychological or spiritual disease that allows humans to attack the biological fabric out of which our own lives, too, are woven. This stems from human-centeredness and the ensuing illusion of separation from nature." The term was coined by philosophy professor Arne Neis, who claimed that ecological ideas are not enough. We need ecological identity, ecological self. Like I like to say, you know, let's compost the hubris, you know, the hubris of humanism, and ladle out the truth of animism, participatory animism, as opposed to the Republican Hinayana Honky, "I've got mine." So, So you then led us into the word soundscape. Do you want to begin with soundscape?
Yeah. Arne Neis is really an amazing systems thinker, and you know, we need more of that type of thinking, that people that really look at how things kind of fit together as opposed to how we can tear them apart. And we're getting a little more of that. Oddly, something that's helping us out is all the computing power that we're bringing to bear on all the data. And back, you know, 20 years ago, we would go out and record a biological environment, a habitat, you know, something, a coral reef area or deep ocean. And the joke was back then, there's not enough undergrads to analyze all the data because you have hours and hours and hours of linear sound. Now we're getting to a situation where we can actually evaluate it through kind of machine learning and what have you. And about 6 years ago, I'm a member of the International Standards Organization Committee on Underwater Acoustics Terminology. So basically what we do is we decide words that would be useful and define them in quantitative terms. You know, how do you actually quantify this word and make it useful when you start to either set up legislation or do scientific research? And I introduced the word soundscape. And, you know, most of the people in the room are either physicists or biologists, but largely comes from the scientific paradigm of when you separate stuff out and evaluate all the bits, somehow you can reassemble them in ways that are scientifically credible. But the word soundscape doesn't really... So there were some wrinkled noses, but I managed to kind of argue my point and get it in there. As it happens, in the last couple of years, this word has become, you know, all the rage in the bioacoustics community as ways of evaluating, you know, biological health of habitats. When you actually hear a habitat that sounds complete, that all the acoustical ranges from low frequencies to high frequencies are robust and not interfering with each other, then we know we have a biological healthy habitat. And if there's holes in it, you know, maybe there's no high frequency of dolphins or invertebrates, you know, barnacles or things like that are not there. So what happened there? Or if there's no low frequency of the great whales, like, where do they go? So we can now look at this systematically through this concept of soundscape. And Arne Næss is, he was kind of feeling a little bit, despondent because he saw this deconstruction of our habitat of systems or civilizations and cultures. But now we're having ways of actually reassembling it and creating it in its wholeness and including our own membership to that. So that's something that's actually helped us a lot.
So shall we hear what the bowheads think about that?
Yeah, sure.
do you want to introduce the bowheads? A little snippet of them.
Bowhead whales are an Arctic species. They're cousins to the North Atlantic right, or the right whales generally, and they're surface feeders. And we used to think they just kind of grunted and snorted and squealed, but now they're realizing that their songs are every bit as complex as the humpback whale songs, which are more evocative because of where they fall in human hearing range. But the bowheads, this would be a very short snippet of a bowhead song.
Okay, so here we go, bowhead song. There they are, speaking to us from the Arctic, and that guides us into right when Ally Jett and other people sent me this, horrific but important and but horrific article from the Guardian. Melting point, could cloud brightening slow the thawing of the Arctic, right? And I read it and thought, oh my God, what's Michael's deft response, right? And you wrote back this perfect thing. Do you have it in front of you?
Not quite scathing.
But deft.
Deft, okay, yeah. So what I wrote was, this is one of those idiot proposals that has been stumbling around for the past 30 years and pointed to by people who marginally believe in science, telling us what not to worry about because the scientists will figure it out. Grabbing at straws, it sounds like to me. There's this little thing called inertia. So when scientists really figured it out 40 years ago that the economists didn't like the numbers, the economists figured that all we needed to do when the time came was turn down the thermostat and the planet would go into a market correction. But with the entire planet and its thermal trajectory, it will not slow down for about 10,000 years. And other than that, everything is fine.
Right, that's right, right. So yeah, and the article I can post it, I suppose. People can find it online, but it's like, oh, no, it's not geoengineering, it's biomimicry. We're going to put carbon dioxide into the air and in the Arctic and just cool it down. Anyway, it goes on like that, but
Oh, it's
everything
not
is
carbon,
like,
it's sulfur dioxide. It's even
oh,
worse.
no, thank you. Thank you. Right,
Yeah.
sulfur dioxide, God. Right. So yeah, another and yeah, every sentence was, every sentence which was proudly proclaimed as like, and we're going to do this, and this isn't a problem, is like, our coyote hackles go up going on. That's why I had to turn to you. Yeah, that was a deft analysis, right? Going, right, because you said we don't have to worry about global warming because the scientists will figure it out, or actually the engineers. No, okay. So there's that. So we're moving on to consider replacing human galumphy trampling on complexity, because it's like, well, we'll just anyway, it's just so annoying. And
We'll just turn the
invoking,
lights down a little bit. It'll be okay. It'll be more romantic. Whatever.
right. And the crucial phrase we all want to keep in our pocket, now wait a minute. And then because you know about everything, we want complexity, we want oceanic complexity, everybody. Did you know about how wind farms noise may muck up birds' capacity to migrate? Yeah, you were just telling me about this. Let's put this on our council table.
Yeah, this is something because the wind farm idea, it sounds good. We're pivoting away from fossil fuel, but the way we're doing is we're unplugging the pipeline and plugging in the power cable and heading in the same direction. Yeah. So there's a lot of
Yeah,
problems
okay.
with that. And I could, I could go on. I've been working on it for 2 years now and trying to convince people that we've got something else to really craft our forward trajectory. But one of the things that came up is this: when the wind blows and turns the turbines, there is a stalled bubble of wind in front of the mast, and that is intersected by the blade. And the blade looks like it's traveling slow, but when you have a 300-foot blade and it takes 7 seconds to go around this circle, the tips are going like 270 miles an hour. I mean, they're moving right along. But this blade will intersect that bubble and create a thump. And that thump is what we call infrasonic, is below what humans can hear. But it is very loud to the d degree that it actually creates seismic disturbance on land-based turbines. But the thing that we have to be careful about is that birds use barometric cues as navigation cues to determine, when to take off. And if there's an unstable barometric front, they know that if they take off, they're going to be buffeted by oncoming winds that are from an unstable weather front. But once there's a really smooth glide to a low pressure zone, they know that a storm front's coming, which is stable, and they can get up in front of it and they get a tailwind. And the tailwinds can be 250 miles an hour. So that's how they move 5,000 miles across, expanses of water or what have you. The problem is when you have all this infrasonic noise of, say, 1,000 or so turbines off the Atlantic seaboard in the Atlantic Flyway, that will probably interfere with birds' ability to be able to accurately determine when a good weather front's coming in. And I maybe everybody saw this. I certainly noticed that when we had the answer pause right after the COVID thing hit us and March of 2020, February, March of 2020, people stopped driving their trucks and their cars, and all this kind of surface noise went away. And I started seeing robins flocking like warblers. I mean, in a really tight flocking pattern. This is something you don't really see robins doing. And I thought, what's doing this? And I realized all those trucks and all those cars, which are creating an infrasonic noise field, these animals can't synchronize their wing beats with each other because it's too noisy. And so we're going to probably do the same thing to all the passerine, migratory passerine birds. And we know that, the tubular birds, the Procelliforms, which are, like the albatrosses and the shearwaters and what have you, when you put a a turbine up, they get away from, they get away like 25 kilometers. They stay away from it. So we're going to have a challenge with all this low frequency noise. And I was in a conference a couple of weeks ago with a bunch of ornithologists, and we're talking about, you know, birds and bad impacts on of these turbines. And I mentioned this, and it was one of those really pregnant silences. You know, we had about 15 people pro, you know, ornithologists. And it was like you could kind of hear the, ooh, the gasps, like, oh, my God. So we're moving fast. We're barreling ahead largely because we're looking at the need for energy, because energy consumption has been correlated with economic growth. And it's a false correlation, and it's also one that's obviously very pernicious. But what we need to look at is using less energy. So we're not right. shifting over to something with equal or greater ability to be able to generate energy. There's a lot of problems. That's one of the problems. That's on the Atlantic side. On the Pacific side, we have this wind that's constant, offshore wind, blowing towards to the shore. And it does a lot of things. But if you convert that, you know, 10 gigawatts of wind power into electrical power, it stops doing the wind thing. Well, what is one of the wind things it does, which is important to the coast of California here, or just the whole Pacific coast? It drives this nutrient upwelling all along the coast here, which is...
Wait, say that again. It drives what?
The nutrient upwelling from deep water. So you have wind friction on the surface of the water creates a California current system, which brings up deep water nutrients, which feeds, you know, the bottom of the food chain off the coast here. And that's why we have huge schools of migrating blue whales and all the fishing that happens off here. They thrive off of this nutrient upwelling. Well, if you turn that wind into electrical power, it stops doing the upwelling thing. So one of the more conservative models is sponsored by the California Energy Commission, or Ocean Protection Council, excuse me. Looks at a decrease of upwelling by 15%. Okay, that's 15% less life to feed all the, you know, less to low trophic level life to feed the other animals. I mean, that's not trivial. That's pretty big. So if we head off in this direction, the discussions we have to look at systematically. It's not, okay, great, we're not putting more carbon in the air. I mean, that's something that's important. But we also have to say, and not just for the life itself, if you want to look at from economic terms, just look at the fisheries and look at all the, you know, whale watching and all the things that we humans, you know, have reduced down to an economic exchange. That's going to go away.
Right. Oops. Right. No. That's right. Well, it all goes back to your deft analysis. It's like, you know, all the beings are like, oh, don't worry, we have this figured out. The scientists will figure it out. Yeah, and come back just to your thing, going, the only way out is using less energy, right? It's a maturation of the populace in some form, and then because you'd offer, I mean, I think for everybody that's really important to know. Did you know complexity? And as Bruce Lipton says, there's no side effects. There's just effects, right? Side effects may include, you know, devastation of the of whales, and because you'd also, you know, spoken and written about the hazard to whales of the wind farms, the whales diving down to scoop up, you know, the nutrient, and if you encounter a huge concrete block, you were a whale, you might. Damage or break your jaw, right? Is that what you were writing about?
Yeah, to be in the California coast, we have these floating wind farms because it's too deep out there to do this pile driving thing that they're doing on the Atlantic seaboard. So you have all this cabling, both in terms of tethers catenary cables that basically keep the turbine in floating in place, but you also have these electrical cables that are going from place to place. And these are cables typically where forage fish, little anchovies and sardines or whatever, they aggregate around that stuff. Well, that's the food that these whorquals and humpback whales feed on. And the way they feed is they open their mouth to like 90 degrees and they chase into these big bait balls and they close their mouth and then they kind of squirt the water out and the fish remain. Well, if the little fish are aggregating around cables and this whale is hitting it at 6 meters a second, which is about as fast as kind of a fast jog is, imagine them hitting, hitting a signpost or a telephone pole at that speed. This would be perhaps an equivalent. We don't know if these animals will have adapted to it at some point in time. I mean, the blue whales, fin whales, sea whales, they're not, they don't have fast environmental habitat adaption characteristics. I mean, unlike the humpbacks, which do figure things out pretty fast. But I don't know. You know, nobody knows at this point in time. But it's like, before we do this, we should check this out.
Right. Right. Well, now, wait a minute. And did you know? And have we studied this? You know, yeah. And have we taken into account the lives of others? Right? The lives of others. And then people come back and go, well, what's your solution, right? And you go, use less energy. And they go, that's not good enough. Do you have other things that you feed them to? Use less energy is important. But if you could wave your hand, what would you do with the wind farms and all?
Well, I would go back a little bit into the system here and say that everybody driving in their own little car is not necessarily a positive objective. I mean, I live out in the country, and they say when you live out in the country, you need service transport. But where I live, you know, it's 100 yards from what used to be a train platform. They tore it, I think, in 1963. And I would have been able to jump on the train there and take that train. I live in Marin County. I would have been able to take that train to Sausalito, grab a ferry, take that down to the city. And if I wanted to take a little bit more train riding, I could grab a trolley on the Embarcadero and take that across the Bay Bridge into Berkeley and up into Albany and certainly to the edge of Richmond. And all the while, instead of looking at my speedometer or looking at my electric charge meter, I could be working. I could be traveling around in beautiful places while getting my work done. And so that would be a solution that is not necessarily market based. Although right. that's not saying that it would slow the economy down. It would distribute the economy. So you know, you wouldn't have these large. I go to these offshore wind confluences and things like that. And when I go and it's a business thing, 8 out of 10 sponsors are all, you know, Equinor and BP and Shell and all these oil companies, because they know something really well. They know how to centralize power distribution. So the wind thing, they also know offshore, I guess, kind of the engineering required to float something and get energy off of it, because that's what they've been doing in terms of offshore oil. So they have all the utilities to, you know, and technologies to make this work for themselves. But when, you know, when we're talking to the folks at the California Energy Commission, they're all, you know, nice to us environmental people and saying, okay, we'll think about that, we'll try that out. But when I go into these other meetings, the industry meetings, it's kind of like a feeding frenzy. You can hear them salivating. You can hear the drips of saliva hitting the carpet. it's scary.
It is scary. Well, it's again, we're putting, you know, major human dementor befoiblement on the table, because as I was also mentioning to you, going right, you know, near my house outside Washington, D.C., there's a beautiful island, Plummer's Island. It's the longest biologically studied island in America. It's very dear and wonderful. And the Beltway that runs around D.C. is pretty close. The former governor, and we've got some hope there, and voting really matters on everything, said, well, we've got to expand. There's a traffic problems. We've got to expand the bridge over the Potomac. and maybe wipe out this beautiful little island, because, you know, we need to expand that, and, you know, and some houses will be eminent domained, and, you know, and we're going to widen this, and we're going to have, you know, Lexus lanes for, you know, high whatever, and we're going to outsource the whole thing to an Australian company that gets all the money. It's like, no. And then, you know, in 3 to 5 years, what are you going to do? Are you going to expand it more, another 4 lanes, you know, until there's nothing but pavement anywhere? It's like, this is not the thinking we want. So every time the doggies and I walk by this proposed thing, we go, no, train, solar running, train the thing, and it was somehow. But we do have a new governor, Governor Westmore, and he's put a pause on this horrible thing. But it's the same idea. It's like, yeah, and right now above us soaring, Sun in Sagittarius, Venus in Sagittarius, Mercury in Sagittarius. Venus is at the degree that astrologers call the resolving climate crisis degree, because its image is long-term cyclical foresight. We go, that's what we want, informed understanding of complexity and how to be a good planetary citizen. And Venus is right next to Mercury, whose image is the crown and torch of the Statue of Liberty, the necessity to defend democracy from tyranny. And we go, right, long-term cyclical foresight requires us to defend democracy. Those guys are there. So anything that's anywhere is everywhere, but I'm so, we are appreciative of you bringing up the things that we didn't know, like, because again, people go along with it, like, oh, wind farms, isn't that lovely? There we go. And it's like, no, think about it, you know, and shape-shifting, you know, because what you're doing, and I've often thought that, you know, just like John Seed says, he's not discouraged because he thinks of himself as a part of the rainforest that assumed human form. I think of you as a part of the ocean that assumed human form to come, you know, inform us, because what you're guiding us to is like, imagine being a whale, and here's how you feed, and what would happen. Do you think the whales see the cables?
No. Well, they're down 150 meters or so, and it's right. Pretty dark down there. It's not, you know, it's not in the dark zone, but the vision is not one of the strong suits, and I don't know exactly how they locate the pulsing schools of anchovies or krill or what have you. It could be that they sense them acoustically or through particle motion, because when you have a large school like that, they're moving around and creating this low frequency swishes, which they could probably hear. I don't think they're necessarily seeing them. You know, it's hard to say. You don't really, it's hard to ask a blue whale, so what, you know, how was that for you? What do you see down there?
How's your jaw doing? Did you go to your whale dentist to have your jaw rewired so that you can live? Oh, Lordy. So we're going to, in a moment, have our very short break music, which is the mantis shrimp. And then can you just tell us about the mantis shrimp and weave it all in for us here?
Okay, this is great, because I love these animals. They come in a lot of different species, from the smallest ones that are maybe in inches, you know, 2.5 inches in length, to the large ones, which are like 22 to 24 inches in length. And they burrow in the substrate, in the mud. And a pair will burrow and, in some cases, have a relationship for 20 some odd years. And every season that they come into their frisky moments, they purr to each other. And this is basically a sound that Erica Staderman recorded of these mantis shrimp that are kind of purring a courtship song.
Oh, but I have to go back before, and then we'll play it in a second here. You said they have a relationship for 20 years?
Oh, yeah.
Really? You mean two shrimps are in a dedicated relationship for 20 years?
Yeah. They dig these complex burrows that go down pretty deep relative to their body size, and they hang out.
And they keep romance alive by singing these songs?
Yeah.
So after 20 years, they're not bored with their partner. They're like, I've got another song for you, darling.
Yeah, I'm going to go down to the bar and hang out with the boys. they don't do that. They're in it.
Oh, that's
life.
So great. Okay, well, here it is. It's a little snippet of the mantis shrimp courtship song. Here we go. That's very charming. Welcome back, team. That was our very short break music of the Mantis Shrimp Courtship Song. And our wonderful guest, Michael Stocker, was just telling us that mantis shrimp have burrows and they have relationships that go on for 20 years. And we eat them? You know, is that like shrimp that we eat? That's just a terrible thing.
It's a type of shrimp, but they're eaten in some places. They're popular in Asia where, you know, they're very resourceful in terms of harvesting food out and protein out of the water. But yeah, you can get them in Asia in fish markets. I don't see them over here very much because they're a little scary. I mean, they're mantis shrimp, but they also the way that they subdue their prey is they basically punch them out, and they have this lightning fast. Kind of feet in front that they have problems keeping these in aquariums because they shatter the glass. It's literally that fast and that hard. So
good for them. Yeah,
yeah, good for them. it's hard when you think about eating any. You know, the orange roughy is an animal that was. You know, there was a huge. They found these things down at like. You know, 4,000 or 5,000 feet, and they were in huge densities. And so he started fishing them back in the '80s, and they called it poor man's lobster because it had lobster texture to it. But there was so much of it, they just thought, God, it was selling it for 2¼ a pound. And then as they started kind of decreasing in their takes, they realized, you know what, these animals are not fertile until they're like 35 years old, and they live 200 years.
Oh my God.
So, you know, when you start thinking about those types of, I see, maybe this animal is wiser than me.
Right. And has courtship songs, which I love Martin Prechtel's one joke. He says, American men need to learn more about courtship. What passes for courtship with American men is, look, I made a golden statue of myself for you. So he recommends, you know, humans study courtship and, you know, start with the mantis shrimp who have 20-year relationships, right? And, many that you have spoken to go, I like to eat shrimp, but I can't because I talk to Michael Stocker. Because the other shrimp are there's so much carnage in the harvesting of shrimp, right? Do you want to give a little just public service announcement about why it's bad to eat shrimp?
Well, I mean, these animals are pretty low in the trophic level, and so there are oftentimes other fish around feeding on them, fish and whales and dolphins and whatever. So when they go after them, the bycatch is incredible. It's like literally 10 pounds of bycatch for 1 pound of shrimp. And they just grind that stuff up and throw it overboard. That's in the farming. I'm not. That's not the farming. That's the wild catch. The farming is another story where they basically rip up mangroves in intertidal areas and create these fish farms or shrimp farms. And they, because of the chemicals that they need, the antibiotics and what have you, to keep these tightly packed animals together. Antibiotic is not just antibiotic on the bacteria and viruses that may affect the shrimp. It's also antibiotic on the habitat. So after about 5 years of a shrimp pen, they got to abandon it and move on somewhere else. That area remains antibioticized for a long time.
Mm.
So it's a huge environmental cost for those little shrimpies.
The environmental cost. Well, I'm sorry, say it again.
Huge environmental cost. In wild catch, you know, in wild caught, it's a bycatch, it's gargantuan bycatch. And in farmed, it's, it's basically the destruction of mangrove swamps and other intertidal intercoastal areas.
Right. So here we are, you know, radio magic, and Jupiter every night, so bright. And tonight, Jupiter will be right next to the moon. You can't miss it. You can't miss either one of them, the waxing moon. So there's a beautiful design of Neptune and the moon and Jupiter in Pisces at a 90-degree angle to the Venus and Mercury in Sagittarius. These are the two Jupiter realms, the inner ocean, deep, deep questing, curious realm, and the outer quest. And what I was saying to you, backstage is the medievals thought of Jupiter as a guardian angel. And I love the NASA report from, I think, a year and a half ago that said, NASA said, any solar system that has a dry planet like Earth, and then they said, you might wonder why we call Earth dry, but it's a tiny percentage. I mean, do you know what it is, the tiny percentage of water, really? But they said any dry planet solar system will have a Jupiter-like planet because Jupiter protects the Earth from asteroids. I go, oh, that's so great.
Oh,
Yeah.
interesting.
And they said in any solar system where you have an Earth-like planet, you're going to have a Jupiter planet to protect it. And I go, oh, that's so Jupiter, the protector, the guardian angel, all the science and myth so happy together, really, and the way I've like to explain it to people with a strong Jupiter, and let's say we all have a strong Jupiter as guardian angel, if we ever get transfixed by the impossible and realistic gloom, like, oh, Jupiter assumes shapeshifts, very shapeshifty time, like a wise grandmother who comes up behind us and snaps her fingers and goes, time for a cup of tea, snap out of the dark trance, the doom scrolling, right there, which is, and then the other way I like that we're encouraging in all of us here is each planet, each part of our interior democracy that connects us to outer democracy has a default setting of, and Jupiter's primary default setting to everything is curiosity. And that's the best guardian angel. And that's really, what you very strongly embody, Michael Stocker, curiosity about complexity and did you know? And there's nothing more important. There might be some things as important, but nothing more important than expanding our curiosity and knowledge base about effects and if we do this and respect. And then just one more thing, and I want to toss it back to you, but I love this pattern, this Sagittarius Pisces pattern. All the Jupiters are here. And it reminds us that we know that cultures symbolically embedded their science in their myths and fairy tales. The Inanna myth is the Venus astronomical cycle, and William Irwin Thompson does a genius analysis of the fairy tale Rapunzel, in which he gets the entire history of the planet and the origins of sex and botany, and I mean it goes on. But so what happened, of course, is the unsupervised, guys or maybe gals too, came along and said, "We don't need these." Myths, these fairy tales, these symbolic languages like astrology, fuh, we want just science, right? So it stripped science of its mythological moral cocoon that it be used in dedication and consideration of collective well-being, right? And so this reweaving, which you do, you scientist, poet, jazz musician, which is perfect. And I have to tell you one other thing. As a community service, every year, me and a number of the other tarot people or astrology people or witches in the community, we read children's fortunes at the cute, very cute community center for Halloween, and it's little 8 and 9 and 10 year olds, and there was a 9 year old little being, and I think multiple Pisces planets. I'm doing fast charts, and I go. The ocean. He goes, I love the ocean. I love the ocean. I want to study whales. I want to study the whale songs. And I go, oh, and I have this wonderful friend I should connect you to, Michael Stocker, and he's also a jazz musician. And this 9 year old said, I love jazz. I love ocean and jazz. And I go, I got to connect you. Isn't it,
Wow.
darling?
Yeah. Where is he? I'll talk to him.
I know, exactly. I gave them my card, and I go, here, have this young man look. We'll hook him up. But I also love this astrology language so much because I just for the fun of it, you, like Raphael Warnock, are a king for goodness, convening the round table. But just for the fun of it, and here you are, illuminating what most of us don't see, these deep, deep places. And your Jupiter quintiles Neptune. Jupiter and Neptune are called the two rulers of Pisces, the ocean. And the quintile is the 72-degree angle of exquisite, irresistible influence. So I go, I just wanted to do a shout out going, you are yourself. It's very, and also the capacity, the quintile 72-degree angle is the capacity to open portals between worlds, says my ally Sylvia Henley. And that's kind of what you're doing. Let's open the portal between curiosity and wonder and do these things. And the more we know, the better citizens we can be. And then speaking
You
of
know,
better
that's.
citizens, oh, what, say.
Oh, go ahead.
No,
I was
you
just going to
go.
say about curiosity. Yeah, well, the curiosity thing was, you know, I mean, I was, I guess all of us are born curious, and sometimes it gets scared out of us for whatever reason. I was fortunate that my mother, particularly, but both my parents were, you know, curiosity was something that drove them as well. But my mother used to take me down to Little Laguna. I lived in Southern California. And she would just drop me in the tide pool, and then she'd go out on the beach and crack a novel, you know, and she'd be done with done for the day. I'd just be there kind of pawing around. And I remember one time there was a culvert that was dripping water down off this cliff into this tide pool. And when I, there was not a lot of life in the tide pool, but when I splashed in it, I noticed there was freshwater floating on top of salt water. And you can see this because you can see the different densities in the way it refracted light differently. And, you know, I was probably 9 years old or something like that. And I said, and there was this couple, young couple, probably teenagers walking by. And I said, hey, look at this. This freshwater floating on top of saltwater. Saltwater is denser than freshwater because it has salt in it. And the guy said, yeah, sure, kid, and walked on. And I didn't feel offended. I felt like, oh, he's missing part of this mystery. It's unfortunate for
Right.
him. But, yeah.
No,
But
the
you're
magic
so lucky.
doctor sends again, because you said the other crucial word, mystery, curiosity and mystery, that this is these are the realms of the ocean, these are the realms of Jupiter, Neptune, these are the realms that are like, oh, humans, you know, dissolve certainty out of your being. It was always a booby prize, right? And replace it with curiosity and wonder in order to re-enter the dance, you know. And so we love that. But I think this might be the way to honor your ally that I read about, you know, David Lee Hoffman, and just to bring him up, because here's an example of, well, you can introduce him and his plight and how we might support somebody who's really full of curiosity and wonder and ingenuity, right?
David is an amazing guy. He's quirky, and I mean, he was born in a family of abundance, so he's never had to worry that much about what he was going to do next. And when I met him in 1981, he had been traveling the previous decade around the world and recording sounds, lots of sacred ceremonies. In Bhutan was the thing that drew me to his library. I was working on the movie Clan of Skazi at the time, and also at the time I was putting together transitions and musical interludes for the movies before Philip Glass got really fully involved in the movie. But so we have this recorded music, and we want to get the original. So me and my assistant came up here, and David, my assistant David, went to Zoetrope, and he was pawing around in that library and finding various sounds to work with. And I went up to David's place, and he has spent the last 50 years now building this unbelievable mythological complex using a lot of the architectural cues that he got from around the world. And it's beautiful. It's just with his materials he uses, and you know, wood and stone and concrete and water, and I mean, the place is, it's just, I don't know how to explain it. He's a kind of an environmental artist. And there's a lot of interesting things he's done with this as well, in terms of how he plants, how he uses his wastewater. He's got a gray water system that drains into a worm box, that then drains into a moat that, you know, has duckweed and all kinds of other plants on it that he calls the intestines of the system. And at the end of this, the water is crystal clear and just fresh like a spring. And he's doing the same thing with this, you know, black water waste, where he's using worms to compost it. And what comes out of this is this beautiful, dark, fluffy, loamy dirt, which he uses in his garden. So if you are so lucky as to dine there, you're eating stuff out of his garden, which is basically landed in his compound to basically feed it. And anyways, what's happening, unfortunately, is because he has not permitted any of his buildings, he's gotten into a dust up, a 10-year now dust up with the county, and they basically want to go tear this place down. And they want to build two 6,000 square foot houses, so, you know, four bedroom houses, and, you know, sell it and make money off of it. And it's like, this place is beautiful. It's visionary. It has got so many layers
and people,
so much depth to
and
it.
People visit, right? I mean, it's called The Last Resort.
Yeah. The Last Resort, you can get, there's a website called The Last Resort in Lagunitas. And it's really amazing. He talks about his composting toilet system. He talks about energy use. He talks about a lot of things and also shows us the beauty of his aesthetic. And they want to just bulldoze the place and kick David off of it and turn it into a market, you know, two market houses, because he's got a couple of acres there. And like, don't do that. What they could do is they could basically, I mean, David wants to create beauty. And, you know, maybe let him live, you know, the rest of his years, because he's an older fellow. He's got, you know, maybe 10, 15 years to go. And then at the end, he could bequeath it to the county, and the county could use it as a retreat center, as an example for architects around the world as to what can be done with various materials. I mean, they could do beautiful stuff with this if they wanted to. But, if you know, the supervisors are gnashing their teeth right now. It's not a pretty sight. So we're trying to support it. If you want to get into supporting the Marin County Board of Supervisors, I've been writing letters. I've been asking other people to write letters. There are a lot of people interested in the thing. We're not going to do the pitchforks and torches thing, but we're going to figure out some way, a whimsical way of at least slowing down this inexorable land grab that the county wants to do, so they can turn it over and make money.
But also, he owns the land, right?
Yeah. Oh, he owns the land, yeah.
Yeah. So how un-American is this? I mean, what?
Well, he didn't play by the rules. He needed to
Right,
get,
it's a Saturn issue. It's a Saturn issue. Yeah.
I remember, you know, when I first met him, the building inspector was coming around saying, hey, you got to permit these places. He said, why would I want to permit it? You know, he couldn't get permitting for the type of architectural and engineering he was doing. It's just not in the, you know, in the uniform business building code. He couldn't get it permitted because the techniques he's using originate, you know, hundreds of years ago in Bhutan and Lhasa and whatever. You know, those buildings have been standing for a long time. He's using the same kind of techniques that they use, that the Incas used in Peru, where these buildings continue to stand even though the churches that the Westerners put up fall down every time there's an earthquake. And so you can't get that permitted. And so he didn't. Anyway, the guy was saying that the building inspector was saying, well, you know, you got to permit this place. He says, well, what good would it do me? Well, if you don't permit, you can't sell it. He says, I don't want to sell it. I just want to give it to my daughter. And he's not trying to aggregate money. He's trying to create beauty.
Right.
And that's just the sad part about it. It really, one of the tragedies here is it really reveals the dearth of imagination of the Marin County Board of Supervisors.
Right. Well, and again, it ties us into everything, you know, in the world that we want to conjure. And even now, oh, dedicated participant, listening citizens, you know, that his work, his dedication should be honored as a mentor. Good heavens, lad, what wonderful. We should duplicate this. Let us come study this. Let's have retreats here. Let's have children's programs there. Exactly. And it is part of the Dementor, you know, glumpiness of to trample on complexity and go, and the outsourced autonomy of the permits and stuff. And so, you know, when you'd written your beautiful, moving, effective letter to the Marin Board of Supervisors, then you posted it on Facebook, which is where I found it, and then I know people that know him, and there's yourself, and we go, right. So it was very dire that apparently they were going to make him move, make a citizen who owns land move, okay, on December 3rd, but that's not happening now. We're going to stay in touch with this team, and he couldn't join us on the air today because he's doing important things, which is great. Keep making beauty. But you have said that people can again write to support this in a not torches and not pitchforks kind of way.
They can write it to the board. Yeah, to the board. It's just basically saying that you want to support, you know, beauty, creativity, and art.
Yes.
And whatever else. But go to the website. I mean, check this stuff out, and you know, be inspired. And
And then write a letter to the Board of Supervisors. You can write each individual one, which is probably be helpful because the guy who's in the 4th District here is a nice guy who talks out of both sides of his mouth quite effectively. But the Board of Supervisors, 3501 Civic Center Drive, Suite 329. And that's in San Rafael, California, 94903. And if these guys get a, and you can just postcards, but if they get, you know, just, it's called The Last Resort, and just you could write a postcard and say, please save The Last Resort. And mm-hmm. if they get flooded with these things, they may go, oh, there actually is something more under this other than turning it into super houses.
Right, right. Well, yeah, and that's why, you know, for all of us who aspire to be, you know, liberating agents and said, you know, did you know is so useful. Did you know about the wind farms and the thing? Did you know about some of the beauty he's creating? It's beautiful and useful. And did you know about William Morris honoring the beautiful and the useful? Did you know? Yeah. So you said there was a website, and could you repeat that website again?
The website's called The Last Resort. And it's in Lagunitas. And so it's, I think, thelastresort.com. Spelled out.
Right. Okay. And that's good. And that possibly has a.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. No, I didn't have. Doesn't have any hooks into it. Just talks. It tells a story. So yeah, there's no link that sends a letter off to somebody. It just tells.
No. This is also charming too, because it's the magic. You're suggesting that people actually write a letter and put it in an envelope with a stamp, and you know, send it to the Board of Supervisors in San Rafael, California. Well, that's charming and magic too. That's a lot of intention rather than just clicking. So in our waning moments we go, okay, we'll keep on that, but support, you know, ingenious beauty is the wave of the future, right? There we go. And we would like his David Lee Hoffman's issues with Saturn to be resolved in a non-harmful way, like work it out with your father and maybe the Board of Supervisors will back off. But you know, in the realm of curiosity and wonder, you know, just, you know, again, equilibrium, harmony with nature, all the things at the heart of your dedication. And then I brought up, you know, the viruses in the excellent book called Spillover about viruses that just says, you know, just established fact, ecological disturbance causes diseases to emerge. It's just a scientific fact, right? So when will the pandemic end or the pandemics end? When humans quit despoiling the earth and behave more like yourself and David. You know, it's like we want to go this way, right? This is it's like the beavers fireproof the land, you know, the likes of yourself. Yeah. Also, David Lee Hoffman, you know, virus proofs or harmful virus proofs the land, right? You know, by cooperating and reestablishing equilibrium. And then you, when I mentioned viruses, you were like, viruses are, we need them. They're,
yeah,
and the virus is asking us to change.
They ask us to change. I mean, we would not have complex organisms in the planet if we didn't get the prokaryotes to kind of cooperate with each other through kind of viral modifications of their RNA. And it's, that starts from there. And every time we have a really kind of a significant break in the complexity of life on Earth, the viruses are around there, you know, playing coyote. And so it's, and we've got that now. You know, what happened in the anthropause? Okay, you can say a lot of mean things happened because people talked about this conspiracy and blah, blah, blah. But also, we understood what happens when we stop driving our cars. What, you know, who are, in fact, the critical workers are not the people who are being paid $2.5 million a year. It's the people who are being paid $14 an hour. Those are the critical workers and the teachers and all these, you know, all of a sudden we start seeing the structure of our society and what's really important as being things that we have to make viral exceptions to. So we, you know, we've not learned the lesson yet. It's still around.
Right.
But we're learning it.
Oh, I see. What? Okay, we're not. We're not. We're not. Never mind. That was fan mail from some flounder coming in. But we're approaching our outro, which is our belugas. Do you want to just weave? And we're going to see vote rousing sanity and rousing voter turnout. In Georgia, we would like it to be resounding vote for sanity. Protection for all our allies. And so here introduce us to the belugas, which is what we ride out on.
So beluga, so one of the kind of the final evolutionary principles has to do with culture. And the idea that humans have culture is pretty indisputable, but do these other animals have culture? Well, the belugas are probably one of the most acoustically complex animals in the ocean. These animals, about 20 of them here, they're hunting cooperatively. They're doing two things simultaneously. They're basically strategizing. So there's some social calls that they're using, the ones that we can hear, and then all the clicks are their biosonar calls. And
Okay, we got to do
the
it. We
data speaks
got to play
that.
them now.
Okay, let's go.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Let's
Here's
go.
their clicks, their social calls, and this is what they have to say to us. Here's the belugas. Wow, that's so amazing. That's so great. I'm just coming back on the other side of it to say thank you, Kirsten Thomas, always, and thank you, Michael Stalker. And I guess we have a few seconds here, but that's amazing, right? Causing board up and myself to go. That just sounds like digital noise, and it's like no, it's them, isn't it? It's just amazing.
Yeah. And it's so much easier to listen to than digital noise. So one of the things that we're trying to persuade the people who want to do the underwater Internet of Things, which would be digital noise, to look at that beluga call and say, that doesn't sound annoying. Why? Let's see if it's a high baud rate. Let's see if we can use that to communicate underwater as opposed to that.
Okay, we're on our
Okay,
way out.
Michaela.
Always a delight to cahoot with yourself, full of curiosity, wonder, and invaluable contributions to human culture. Thank you so much, Michael Stalker. Again,
Likewise, Carolyn.
ocean
Thank you so much.
conservation OCR.org is great, and thanks always again to Kirsten Thomas. I'm Caroline Casey. We will reconvene next week. Woof. Swoosh.
I hope.
Oh.
Oh, yeah, yeah.